Welcome to Dominican University of California. And I see all of you up there too. Welcome. This is the spring lecture series in partnership with Book Passage. This is our 11th year. And in this spring season, we have had so many remarkable speakers. Tonight, we have David Brooks in the house, and I'm so happy to have you join us. Please welcome him. The Institute for Leadership Studies is a leadership development center. And my name is Denise Lucy. I'm the director of that center and a professor of business. And it's my pleasure to welcome students, faculty, and staff, and our neighbors to join together in very important conversations that cut across the disciplines with relationship to leadership. Tonight's featured guest, David Brooks, is a Marin favorite. Looking to some of the world's greatest thinkers and inspiring leaders, Mr. Brooks' book explores how, through internal struggle and the sense of their own limitations, they have built a strong inner character. This topic is obviously something that we here at Dominican Inner Institute for Leadership Studies are always discussing. We are so very appreciative to Penguin Random House Publishing for partnering with Book Passage to bring David Brooks to Dominican's Angelico Hall. It is with the support of Private Ocean Wealth Management that we can actually offer these programs. This is their fourth season in doing so. Private Ocean Wealth Management has been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisor firms and best wealth management firms by North Bay Biz. Private Ocean was awarded just this 2014 as the best place to work in the Bay Area by the San Francisco Business Times and the Silicon Valley Business Journal. The CEO and chairman of the board support this program, and we're so happy to know that tonight, Richard Stone, co-founder and chairman of the board, will be here this evening to introduce Mr. Brooks. Mr. Stone is also a trustee of Dominican University, and it's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Richard Stone.
Good evening. This is a little change of program and venue here for a Sunday night. I almost got lost. I'm usually doing this during the week. Our special guest tonight, David Brooks, is the author of The Road to Character. His own road to get there is quite remarkable. Born in Toronto, David graduated from the University of Chicago in 1983 and worked as a police reporter for a wire service owned jointly by Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times. After spending time at the Hoover Institute at Stanford and joining the Washington Times as a movie reviewer, David soon moved to New York, where he went to work for the Wall Street Journal as, ironically, editor of the book review section. The Wall Street Journal ultimately crowned David as an op-ed columnist and sent him to Brussels, where he covered Russia, the Middle East, South Africa, and European affairs. David's next move was back to New York. In 1995, he joined a new magazine, The Weekly Standard, as its senior editor. In 2003, David became an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. His column now appears every Tuesday and Friday. He's currently a commentator on PBS NewsHour, NPR's All Things Considered, and NBC's Meet the Press. David also has been a contributing editor for Atlantic Monthly and Newsweek, a teacher at Yale University, and has become a number one best-selling author. His newest book, The Road to Character, has had a profound effect on David's life. We'll let him explain. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Brooks.
Thank you. It's good to be here in the Bay Area, my political base. A lot of Republicans here. I spent a lot of time here and in Marin And I'll be brief. I know you didn't come here to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak. And so I'll try to get out of the way of that. I should say, I am more on the right, but I didn't start. I started out on the left. My parents were academics in Greenwich Village in the 60s. And in 1965, they took me to a bee-in, where hippies would go just to be. And I saw a piece of, what the hippies did was they set a garbage can on fire and threw their wallets into it to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was five, and I saw a $5 bill in the fire, so I broke from the crowd, reached into the fire, grabbed the money, and ran away. And that was sort of my first step over to the right. I was part of I went to a school called Grace Church School as part of the all-Jewish boys davening choir at Grace. So we were about 40% Jewish because it's lower Manhattan. And we sang these beautiful soprano voices, but square it with our religion, we wouldn't sing the word Jesus. So the volume would drop and then it would come back up. And then as I was telling the group before, I went off to the University of Chicago, a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. But I was actually a socialist. I was picked by Milton Friedman to debate him on my first TV appearance. I was 21, and I was a democratic socialist. Basically, the show was me regurgitating some point I'd read from a progressive economist, Friedman destroying me in about 6 seconds, and then the camera lingering on my face as I tried to think of what to say. It's actually available online if you go on YouTube. You can still see that. A lot of hair, big glasses. It was 1983. And I stayed on the left, and then I moved over to the right for various reasons. But I still like to think I live in a progressive areas of the country. I live half, split my time between Washington, D.C. and Chelsea and lower Manhattan. I shop at grocery stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International. And they couldn't have potato chips or pretzels in the snack food section. That would be vulgar. So what we get is called veggie booty with kale. It's for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colorectal cancer. And so they want that sort of thing. And so in my neighborhoods, like here, a lot of people drive Saabs and Audis and Volvos. It's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. That's fine. And usually the elementary schools, the moms and dads in my social set come out, and some of the moms are what I call Uber moms, who are highly successful career women who've taken time off to get all their kids into Stanford and Harvard. And you can usually tell the Uber moms because they actually weigh less than their own children. They're stepping out of the cars with the spandex, the yoga mats stapled to their hips. Sort of at the moment of conception, they were doing little butt exercises to stay fit and trim. When the babies come out, they're cutting the umbilical cord themselves and flashing little Mandarin flashcards at the things. Meanwhile, their husbands tend to be a little older. They've were successful in business, and they've decided just to not die. And so they've hired three personal trainers. They're seeing Deepak Chopra for their spiritual insides. And then they're popping Cialis like breath mints. They're just throwing them back in there. And I go out to Aspen every summer to get in touch with the real America. I take these hikes, and so these older guys, they're like 90 years old, they've shrunk down, they're like 85 pounds, 4'10", covered in spandex, and they just hike those mountains so fast, they zoom like right by you, like little iron raisinettes. They're just like going up past you. So all that's to say is I feel at home here. I actually did a story for The New Yorker many years ago on Restoration Hardware, which is here in Corte Madera. I'm being taken away.
I'm not going to pull you off the thing. Just going to bend it a little bit closer to you, yeah.
That was going to be the shortest speech in my career. So You have these experiences, these things on the surface of your life, and occasionally you get a moment that surprises you, and it takes you to a different level. And so I had one of those moments. Actually, some of you may know I do a show called The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, with a guy named Brooks, Mark Shields. Our segment is called Shields and Brooks. Yeah. We wanted to call it Brooke Shields. That would have been better, but they didn't let us. And so we were doing it one summer, about many years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And I get out at 7 p.m., and I drove home. Then I lived in Bethesda, and my kids were 12, 9, and 5. And I drove into the driveway, which is sort of on the side of the house, so I could see in the backyard. And when I got home, my kids had a ball you get in the supermarket, and they were kicking it up in the air. And it was like arcing in the wind, and then they were chasing it, and then they were tumbling all over each other in laughter, trying to get the ball. And like the summer evening sun was coming through the trees, and the green was grass. The grass was green. It was like a perfect night, like now, here. And so I drove into the driveway, and I just come across this unexpectedly, the scene of my kids in the backyard. And I just stared at them for a second through the windshield, just like looking at what was tableau in front of me. And it was one of those moments when life and time are suspended, when reality sort of slips outside the boundaries, and you get a feeling of just being overwhelmed with gratitude and sort of subsumed in a beauty that I had not earned. And when you get that strange stirring, you experience a joy that is better than anything you get at work. It exposes your depth. But mostly, I had a sense that you want to be worthy of such moments, just because the life has been so sweet to you. And so you get those moments sometimes when you have an unexpected moment like that. Second, you get them sometimes when you're surrounded by someone who just radiates an inner joy. I happened to be seated next to the Dalai Lama at a Washington luncheon about 6 months ago. And he just radiates with the joy. He laughs at unexpected moments. And so you'll just be sitting next to him and he'll start laughing. And you want to be polite, so you start laughing. And it's just random moments of laughter. And you want to tell a joke just to justify the laughter. Or say something. And so at one point I just said, he has a little Dalai Lama bag, a little canvas bag. And so I saw him in there and I said, do you got any candy in that bag? And so he starts pulling stuff out of the bag, and it's basically everything you get on the first class cabin of an international flight. And so he's got the little eye shades, the earplugs, you know, the little razor and toothbrush sort of thing. And he had a Toblerone bar in there. But and so he had an inner light, and you know, he's a famous global celebrity. But often, I'm sure you have this experience, you run across somebody who's leading a normal life, and they radiate with that inner light. I was in Frederick, Maryland, which is about 60 miles north of where I live, and I met about 50 women who teach immigrants how to read. And to teach them English and then how to read can take years. And I walk in a room with them, and you feel sort of this wave of sweetness and goodness to them, a patience that they had, and their laughter was sort of nice. They made you feel valuable just being there. They weren't bragging about what wonderful work they did. They weren't thinking of themselves at all. And so that, when you see that, you want to, the reaction I had, frankly, was like, I've achieved way more career success than I've ever imagined I would. But you see what those ladies had, that inner glow. I don't have that. How do you get that? And you only get one life. You might as well try to approach that. And so the way I thought about it was divide our virtues into two sets of virtues, the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. And the resume virtues are the things that make us good at our jobs, the things we bring to the marketplace, or you're good at law or teaching or journalism, whatever. The eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead. Are you courageous, honorable, brave? Are you capable of great love? What's the nature of your relationships? And we all know that the eulogy virtues are more important than the resume virtues. But a lot of us, and we certainly have an educational system in general, that is more targeted around the resume virtues than the eulogy ones. And a lot of people have a clear idea of how to build a career, than how to build character. And so I began thinking about this, and a book that helped me think about it was a book called The Lonely Man of Faith by Joseph Soloveitchik, which was written in 1965. And Soloveitchik argues we have two sides of our natures, which he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the ambitious resume side. Adam 1 wants to, you know, build something, make some money, create something in the world. Adam 2 is the internal Adam, wants to embody certain moral qualities. Adam 2 wants to have a strong inner character, a solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good. So while Adam 1 wants to conquer the world, Adam 2 wants to obey a calling and serve the world. Adam 1 asks how things work. Adam 2 asks why things exist and what ultimately we're here for. Adam 1 wants to venture forth. Adam 2 wants to return home to a family meal, friends around a bar. And Soloveitchik argues that these two sides of our nature are in conflict. And I'd say part of the conflict is they operate by different logics. Adam 1, the outside side, operates by an economic logic, which is straightforward. Input leads to output, practice makes perfect, effort leads to reward. Adam 2, the moral Adam, lives by an inverse logic, and his logic is moral, not economic, and it's paradoxical. You have to give to receive. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success leads to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure can lead to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. And so we live in a culture that I think nurtures Adam 1 and ignores Adam 2. We live in a competitive culture where you have to broadcast yourself. You have to spend a lot of time on your career. We live in a fast communication system that drowns out the still small voice of the depth. The meritocracy wants you to be big about yourself, promoting yourself. Social media wants you to put a highlight reel of yourself on Facebook. We have a moral culture that tells people that they are wonderful inside. Think of the commencement cliches, follow your passion, be true to yourself, trust yourself. We tell our kids how great they are, and of course they believe us. In 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? And in 1950, 12% said yes. They asked the same question again in 2005, and 80% said yes. Psychologists have a thing called the narcissism test, where they give people, they read a bunch of statements and they say, does this apply to you? And their statements are things like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary. Or, somebody should write a biography about me. Or, I love to look at my body. And the median narcissism score has gone up 30% in the last 20 years. Along with this has gone an increased interest in fame. UCLA asked college freshmen, what do you want out of life? And the number one answer used to be meaningful philosophy of life. And at the bottom was fame. That was for decade after decade. Now, meaningful philosophy of life is at the bottom. Financial security is at the top. And second or third is fame. Junior high school girls were asked, would you rather be a celebrity's personal assistant to be around fame, as Justin Bieber's personal assistant, or president of Harvard? And of course, by 3-1, they'd rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. Though to be fair, I asked the president of Harvard, and she would rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. College students were asked, would you rather have a life that leads to a lot of sex or a lot of fame? And by 2-1, they chose the life with a lot of fame. And I go to colleges and I say, you know, I'm on TV twice a week. I write for a prominent newspaper. I'm kind of famous. Go with the sex. It's better. But if you lead in that direction, you turn into sort of a shrewd animal. Christian Smith went around college campuses, he's a sociologist at Notre Dame, asking, name your last moral dilemma. And he found that 2/3 of the students couldn't name a moral dilemma. They'd say, you know, I pulled into a parking space, I didn't have enough quarters. He'd say, that's sort of a problem, it's not really a moral dilemma. And he wrote that they're good kids and college students are amazing, but they just haven't been given moral language to think about these things. And that's Adam 1 taking over Adam 2. And I certainly found in my own life that you get so busy, you get caught up in things, you neglect that internal side. You can slip into a self-satisfied moral mediocrity, you grade yourself on a forgiving curve, you think, well, I'm not really hurting anybody, people seem to like me, I must be okay. But slowly you're turning a core piece of yourself into something less impressive than you'd hoped. There's a gap that opens up between the person you want to be and the person you are, and you're not really the sort of person who generates that inner light. You're not the person who will deserve the kind of eulogy you want. You're not the sort of person who people will, you'll get 1,500 people at your funeral, not because they're kissing up to you, because they just genuinely you touch their lives. And so I set off to see how it's done. The people who do lead these beautiful inner lives, how do they do it? And I did it by just looking at, by gathering examples. People whose lives were not that impressive at age 20, but who were super impressive at age 70, internally and externally. And so how do they do it? One of those characters was Dwight Eisenhower. When Dwight was 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating, and his mom wouldn't let him. And so he threw a temper tantrum, and he punched the tree in his front yard, and he punched it so bad that all the skin was rubbed off his knuckles. So his mom, this remarkable woman named Ida, sent him to his room, had him cry for an hour, came up to bind his wounds, and recited a verse from Proverbs, "He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city." And when he wrote his memoirs 7 years later, Eisenhower said that was the most important conversation of his life, because it taught him that he had a problem, which was his temper. And he did have that problem, especially early in life, where he really was getting in fights and hating people. At West Point, he got many, many demerits. But he fought it through the course of his life. So we think of him as a garrulous, optimistic country club kind of guy. But inside, he was seething during World War II in his presence. He was up nights, lying awake, insomnia, anxiety attacks, drinking, smoking, throat infections, blood pressure spikes. But he knew he could not lead that way, so he created a false persona of cheerful optimism. And that was a creation. He was a hater, and he needed to defeat his anger. So he'd write down the names of the people he hated and then rip up the pieces of paper and throw them into the garbage can, sort of as a way to purging himself. And he managed to make himself, by the time he was president and a general, strong in his weakest spots. So it's at the time of war, he's managing this very complicated alliance, everybody's behaving selfishly, but he remained calm and cheerful and was a great leader as a result of that. And so we learned from Eisenhower one step on the road to character, which is the necessity of self-defeat, of understanding your core weakness and struggling against it, and understanding that the most important struggle in life and the most important drama of life is not the external drama against others, it's the internal drama to be better than you used to be. The second figure is Samuel Johnson, who always liked to talk about at universities, because he teaches us that curiosity can be a moral act. Samuel Johnson was born in 1709 in England. He barely survived the ordeal of his birth. He was handed over to a wet nurse whose milk infected him with tuberculosis, which rendered him blind in one eye and deaf in one ear. He developed smallpox, which left him scarred all over. They performed surgery on his jaw, which left a big gouge in his face. They opened up his arm to bleed him, and they left the wound open for 6 years. He soon developed what we now think was Tourette's syndrome and OCD. He was twisting, he couldn't uncontrol his body, whistling, all sorts of habits. It was a challenge to eat around him because he was spewing food. He went to Oxford and dropped out after a year. He opened a school and failed after a year. By 30, his life, as he said, was radically wretched. And so he suffered. Now, sometimes suffering is just suffering, but Johnson was able to take a moment of suffering and turn it into something impressive. And so what suffering does, a 1950s theologian, Paul Tillich, said what suffering does, those moments when we suffer because we lose a loved one or we have a romantic breakup or lose a job or something, they take us beneath the crust of everyday life and they remind us, Tillich said, that we're not who we thought we were. Tillich wrote that suffering carves into what you thought was the basement of your soul, carves into the floor and reveals a cavity below, carves below that and reveals a cavity below. And so Johnson suffered. He came to understand himself. He came to understand the illusion of self-mastery. and he decided I need to just be radical in my understanding. I can't control my mind. I can't control my body. I will understand the world, and I'll anchor myself in the reality of the truth. And so he went off to London, and he just started writing. And he developed this remorseless curiosity. And so somebody told him it was a stretch of river in Oxford that people were drowning in. He leapt into that stretch of river so he'd know what it felt like. Someone told him if you put two musket balls in a pistol and fire it, the gun will explode. So he put seven balls in and shot into a wall. And he just wrote, if you look at his essays, he had essays called Rambler Essays. Everything he's guilty of, his own weaknesses, he writes about them. Sloth, envy, guilt, boredom, everything he's afraid of, he stares at it directly and writes about it. And it's a way of understanding himself. And through self-understanding and through suffering, he develops this amazing empathy about other people. And slowly his character, which had been all over the place and frantic and depressed, becomes solid through the act of intellectual inquiry and then wisdom. And wisdom created a kind of tranquility that he lacked. One biographer wrote that the iron had entered his soul, and he approached questions of human conduct in the light of a terrible experience, which enabled him to penetrate into human motives with sureness and understanding. He was capable of amazing acts of industry. It took the French Academy 40 scholars and 50 years to do the first French dictionary. Johnson did it alone with six clerks in only 8 years. He was writing it between age 68 and 72. He wrote 52 small biographies covering 378,000 words, an amazing feat at any age. And then he started giving away his writing. A friend of his got a law lectureship at Oxford, but unfortunately the guy knew no law. So Johnson said, I'll write your lectures for you. He wrote 60 lectures stretching over 1,600 pages of text, just as a favor. He was part of the most exclusive social circle in Britain in those days with Adam Smith and Edmund Burke and Joshua Reynolds. But at home, he just collected stray people who had nowhere else to go. So there was always like 10 or 13 people living in the home, a former slave, former prostitutes, people with alcohol problems, a doctor who ministered to the poor, had no money. They were all crammed into Johnson's house, and he just protected them. And so by the time he died, he had achieved this greatness. When he died, a colleague said, he has made a chasm which not only nothing can fill up, but which nothing has a tendency to fill up. Johnson is dead. Let us go to the next best. There is nobody. No man can said to be put you in the mind of Johnson. And so he's an example of how suffering can be used, and then how wisdom can be a solidifying force. The third person I'll mention is a woman named Frances Perkins. She was the first woman in the cabinet under FDR. She was Secretary of Labor. She went to Mount Holyoke, one of the schools that leaves a mark on its students. I'll read some rules that were the class of 1902 rules for students at Holyoke, probably different than students here. Freshmen should keep a respectful silence in the presence of sophomores. Freshmen meeting a sophomore on campus should bow respectfully. No freshman shall wear a long skirt or hair high on head before the mid-year examinations. They're teaching deference. Perkins was weakest in the field of chemistry, so they made her major in chemistry. They thought if you can conquer that, you can conquer anything. Holyoke took their students, all women, and gave them a sense of heroic mission. The slogan was go where no one wants to go and do what no one wants to do. So they sent single women in 1902 to Nepal, to Pakistan, to Africa as missionaries and service workers. Somebody did a survey, I think in 1920, of all the female missionaries abroad, and something like 25% of them were Holyoke grads. Perkins didn't go abroad. She went to Chicago, worked at a place called Hull House, and then she came back to New York and was sort of an activist, but she was sort of unfocused. She's having tea in 1913 in Washington Square Park in Lower Manhattan, and she happens across, she hears a commotion, she rushes out in the park, looks down the block, sees a fire, and she stumbled across one of the most famous fires in American history called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. And she sees what she thinks are bundles of clothes being thrown out of the top floor windows, but it's like 9/11, the people are deciding to jump to their deaths rather than burn to death. She sees 53 people go over. There's a guy helping the women over the windowsill. He helps first, a second, third, drops them into space. His fourth is his girlfriend, who he kisses and drops, and then he himself goes. And that moment was what you might call a call within a call. She'd been sort of unfocused and genteel in her activism until that point. After that, she was focused, almost ruthless. She would work with anybody, compromise anything, do anything for the cause of worker safety. She goes up to Albany, becomes a lobbyist, but she's working with machine politicians, and they won't, it's 1920, they won't take her seriously because she's a young woman. And she keeps a folder at home called Notes on the Male Mind. She says, they won't take me seriously as a young woman, but they all want to be loved by their mothers. And so what she does is she dresses like an 80-year-old woman. Pearls, frumpy dress, tri-corner hat, old-fashioned hairstyle, gets the nickname Mama Perkins, and becomes phenomenally successful. And then later becomes Secretary of Labor. But she teaches us the power of picking a vocation. And oops, you know, we tell our students the commitments, follow your passion. 80% of students don't have a passion. And so she found her vocation not by looking inside herself and being self-interested. She found her passion by looking around at the world and not saying, what do I want from life, but rather, what is life asking of me? What problem do my circumstances present to me? And worker safety was one, and she spent her life dedicated to it. And she's the power of vocation in building character. Just two quick more. Dorothy Day, a young Catholic activist, she was still an atheist as a young woman. She was the sort of person who couldn't read books. She had to act them out. And unfortunately, she read a lot of Dostoevsky. And so she early, through her 20s, she's drinking a lot, sleeping around a lot, carousing, two abortions, suicide attempts. Her life is changed by the birth of her daughter. She's not married, but she gives birth. And she had decided that all the accounts of childbirth she'd ever read were written by men. So 40 minutes after giving birth, she sits down and writes an account. And parts of it are very violent, the pain, but then in the end she writes, if I had written the greatest book, composed the greatest symphony, painted the most beautiful painting, or carved the most exquisite figure, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. No human creature could receive or contain so vast a flood of love and joy as I felt after the birth of my child. With this came the need to worship and to adore. And so she needed to worship something, and she decided God must exist. She became a Catholic because the immigrants community she served were Catholic. And then she spent the next 60 years of her life creating a soup kitchen, creating a radical newspaper, creating homeless shelters, communes, not only serving the poor, but living in poverty, paying herself no salary, and living there with the poor every day for 50 years. And becomes a remarkable figure, and searching intense self-criticism, desiring not only to do good, as Perkins did while making compromises, but to be good. She felt the need to be pure. And she chose us, as a friend of mine says, that love always is on the move. It wants to go outward and build community. The final person who's another example of the power of love is George Eliot, the great novelist. She was born at the start of the Victorian era. Her mom was really sick and could give her no attention. And so Eliot grew up with a desperate need for love. So she, by her 20s, she was priggish, self-righteous, desperate for attention. She fell in love with every man she met, young, old, tall, short, married, unmarried. She'd fall for a guy, he'd be sort of entranced by her conversation, then his wife would kick her out of the house. And so she was very unimpressive, like all these people, very unimpressive as a young person. At age 32, she fell for a guy named Herbert Spencer, a great philosopher. And she wrote him a letter that was at once pathetic and profound. The pathetic part was her begging him to marry her. It was like, you won't even notice me around the house, I won't cause you any problem. But then in the end, she has a flourish. And the flourish is, she wrote, I suppose no woman ever before wrote such a letter as this, but I am not ashamed, for I am conscious in the light of reason and true refinement that I am worthy of your respect and affection. whatever gross men or vulgar-minded women might say. And so she had come to that point in her maturity, which you might call her agency moment, when she stops being reliant on other people's needs and other people's opinions, criticism, or affirmation. She develops her own internal criteria. It doesn't work out with Spencer, but she meets a guy named George Luz, who's also a writer. Now, Luz is legally married, but their marriage had fallen apart. His wife was living with another guy and had three children with that other guy. But it's Victorian Britain, legally, they're married. And if George Eliot goes with Luz, she will be legally an adulteress. She will lose all of her friends, her family will cut her off, she'll be ostracized from society. So she has to choose Luz or everybody else. She thinks about it for a week or two and decides to go with Luz. I have counted the cost of the step that I have taken, and I am prepared to bear without irritation or bitterness, renunciation by all my friends. I am not mistaken in the person to whom I have attached myself. He is worthy of the sacrifice I have incurred, and my only anxiety is that he should be rightly judged. They go off, and they have a happy relationship. And what her story teaches us, not only the daring leap she took, but the power of love to change character. The first thing love does, it humbles you. When you're in love, you're not really in love in control of your own emotions. Love is like an invading army you want to be conquered by. The second thing love does, it plows open hard ground. If you've got the crust of your life, it makes you vulnerable. The third thing it does, it decenters the self. It reminds you that your riches are in another person, not in yourself. The third thing does, it fuses people together, so love eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving, because the personalities are fused. To give something to your friend or your lover, you get more pleasure than the receiver, because you're giving to a piece of yourself. And that's the first romantic love that Taylor Swift sings about. The second love is the one that comes later. She's older by this point, in her 30s. You're a little dented, you're a little bruised, you're shrouded in commitments, and you're realistic. You're not poetic as much. You're realistic about yourself and about the other person. And this love is not idealized, and it is local. A friend of mine described this kind of love in a toast. My friend's name is Leon Wieseltier. He wrote, "This kind of love," this was a wedding toast, "is private and it is particular. Its object is the specificity of this man and that woman, the distinctiveness of this spirit and that flesh. This love prefers deep to wide and here to there, the grasp to the reach. When the day is done, the lights are out, there is only this other heart, this other mind, this other face, to assist in repelling one's demons or in greeting one's angels. It does not matter who the president is. When one consents to marry, one consents to be truly known, which is an ominous prospect. And so one bets on love to correct for the ordinariness of the impression and to call forth the forgiveness that will be required. Marriages are exposures. We may be heroes to our spouses, but we may not be idols." And she had this kind of realistic understanding of Luz and he of her. He said to her a couple years after the marriage, "You should try your hand at fiction," which she hadn't done. She came back in a week with a short story. She read it to him aloud. He started crying. He understood the talent she had. And he spent the rest of his life subordinating his own career to hers, as her agent, her publicist, her editor. She was sensitive to criticism, so he got up early in the morning, cut all the articles out of the newspaper that might mention her so she wouldn't have to read them. And they had a very stable and remarkable relationship. And it's the power of love to deepen someone. When we say that someone has character, we really wouldn't say that about someone who was not capable of great love. We wouldn't say it about someone who had not suffered or had not found a vocation or had not defeated their weaknesses. And so in these cases and these and other cases, what I'm describing is first a phase shift in the way we think. We're taught to think about happiness. We're taught to think we're wonderful inside. We have this golden, wonderful figure inside. But this is a different philosophy. First, that we don't actually live for happiness. We're endowed with moral imagination. We want to feel righteous, that we're leading a good life. and we would rather have a good life with suffering than a happy life of good moods. Second, we're not totally wonderful inside. We're divided creatures, both deeply broken and splendidly endowed. Third, the struggle against weakness and sin is the central drama of life, not the external climb to success. In this struggle, humility is the greatest virtue. Humility is radical self-awareness from a distance. It's seeing yourself honestly as if you were from far away from yourself. It's knowing you're an underdog in the struggle against your success, your own sin. Pride is the greatest vice because pride blinds you to your weakness. Character is built over the years of your confrontation with yourself. No person can achieve self-mastery on his or her own. We all need redemptive assistance from outside. And so we all have to do it together. I used to think when I started this project that character was like this Victorian little iron figure of self-control inside each of us. But no one can beat our weaknesses on our own. Character is really your ability to commit strongly to things outside yourself. So in the realm of the intellect, a person of character has firm convictions about fundamental things. In the realm of emotion, she's embedded in a web of unconditional loves. In the realm of action, she's committed to causes that can't be completed in a single lifetime. And so it requires, I think, just a mental counterculture to move a standard of how to behave, and they set an inspiration. We can all have dead friends, we can have live friends to get together in discussion groups to talk about, well, what does suffering do? What's a moment of failure? How did that change you? Have common conversations. And so all of these are efforts to remember that the eulogy exists, the Adam II exists, to live a life full of moral occasions. And the reward is sometimes a tranquility. We're at a college that was started in a Catholic tradition. So I'll end with a Catholic, great Catholic writer, St. Augustine. He was born in 384 or 354, and he had a mom named Monica who was the helicopter mom to beat all helicopter moms. She was like hunting him down from, wanted to spend all his time with her, telling him what he could do, what he could do, what he could think, what he couldn't think, who he should marry, who he shouldn't marry. He's like, needs to get away from her, leaves Africa, goes to Italy. She's screaming on the shore as he's sailing away. She takes the next boat, she finds him in Italy. And so they have this very conflict-wrenched relationship. But when she's 56, he's had his conversion. He's become the kind of Catholic she wanted and the kind of man she wanted. She basically says, you know, I can die. All I wanted in this life was you to be a certain sort of person, and you are that person. And so she does die 9 days after this. But he describes their final conversation in a garden in a town called Ostia in Italy. And they, after all the conflict, he says, their voices sort of merged sweetly together in their conversation, the final one. And they rose, he wrote, in the very highest delight of the earthly senses, in the purest material light. Their conversation did by degrees pass through all things bodily, even the very heaven when the sun and moon, stars, and shine upon the earth. We came to our own minds and went beyond them into the realm of pure spirit. And then he has a long sentence, which is very hard to parse, but it's got one word repeated throughout it. And the word is hushed. The sound of their voices was hushed, the sound of the wind was hushed, the sound of the birds was hushed, the sound of their breathing was hushed. And you get this sense of a great tranquility settling over them. And Adam I's ambitions are never satisfied. But Adam II's ambitions can be in moments of deep tranquility and moments of peace and maturity. And it is in that, out of that wisdom and that tranquility and equanimity that you get that inner light. And it takes a long time to get there, I suppose, but the people who I've written about did get there. And writing and reading a book don't get you there. You got to live it out. But their lives give us our gift and give us a roadmap for how to do it. Thanks very much. Thank you, and we've got 15 minutes to talk about the Clinton Foundation or whatever you want to talk about. If there are questions, I think we have two microphones here in the aisles.
I don't have a question, but I do have a comment.
Okay.
My comment is I want to thank you for the chapter that you wrote on Francis Perkins. My mother had always told me that Francis Perkins was one of the most wonderful people in the world, and I never believed her. And then I read your chapter. Yeah. I believe it now. She was incredible. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. She was truly incredible. It's just one quick, this is what writers love, these little coincidences. She helped create Social Security. The New Deal was largely her. She held FDR's feet to the fire on all these issues. But the little paradox that I liked, she's 83, she has no money, she's been working in public sector all her life, and she's teaching at Cornell to make a living, and she's still living alone, and a frat house, sort of an intellectual frat house, says, you know, why are you living alone? Why don't you come live in our frat house? And so she says she was as happy as a bride on her wedding day. She was so thrilled. So she went in and lived with them, and she would sit down. They were playing whatever music they were playing, and she's sipping bourbon there at night. And the faculty advisor of the frat house, who she lives directly next to, is a guy named Alan Bloom, who goes on to write The Closing of the American Mind. And the president of the frat house, who turns to become one of the pallbearers at her funeral, is Paul Wolfowitz, who became Secretary of Defense, or Assistant Secretary of Defense. So that's a little paradox. I don't know what it means. It's just cute.
Question? Hi. I read your column this morning in the New York Times about raising kids and telling them they're such always doing a good job and all this stuff. Is that included in the book, or could you elaborate more on that?
The nice thing about being a writer who has to write twice a week is that I have no unexpressed thoughts. Everything is written. And so that actually grew. It's part of it is in the book, a version. But, you know, I teach at Yale. I only teach at schools I couldn't have gotten into. But about 20% of my students, their parents, you know, to get into a place like Yale, it's a team sport. It takes a whole family. But their parents are so into their lives, and the parents are beaming affection at them when they do well and withdrawing love when they're not. And those kids are terrified. The fundamental relationship of their life is contingent on them behaving in a certain way. And there are stories, I could tell you stories, of, you know, the kid takes a job the parents think is unwise, so the parents say, okay, we're not coming to commencement. And it's like, just that you see these things. And so I've become sort of evangelical, I've become fervent on this subject of just lecturing people, just unconditional love. The rest of the world can be harsh on your kids. You get in their corner, just you're for them. But I see an epidemic of conditional love, especially among high-pressure sorts in society.
We have a question right here.
Hi there. In case you don't have another job, you should be a stand-up comic sometime. You do a great job.
Thank you.
You're talking about Adam 1 and Adam 2. I really appreciate the difference. I don't know how much you know about what's really going on in San Francisco right now, but it's hyper-gentrification. And a $5,000 house is now being sold for $7 million in the Marina District. It's really unbelievable. So you have these young kids, these white males, pretty much, in the high-tech world in San Francisco. They don't know anything about Adam 2. And I'm really concerned about that. And I'm just curious about what your thoughts are about where social media is really taking us and all these, you know, exaggerated salaries and Adam 1s in the world.
Yeah, thank you. I think I might be going to Google at some point. I can tell you I haven't had much interaction with this book, with that community. I've had a fair bit of interaction with the hedge fund community in New York, which is similar economic, though culturally a little different. But so my experience is, and I literally had one, I gave a talk at Stanford, Connecticut in a guy's house, and one of the guys came up to me and he said, you know, you're making me feel guilty. And he said, you know, I've lived my life a certain way, I've made money, I got this house, I'm fine. And so I was surprised by how blatant he was about it. and how much pushback you get. There is some hostility toward this conversation, just because they're unfamiliar with it. But I will say for most people, I guarantee you at some point in life, something bad will happen. And you're going to have the resources. And the nice thing about it is it's never too late. You know, Adam 1, you can retire at 60 or 65 or 70 and you're done your career. But the Adam 2 side, it's never too late to have major breakthroughs. And so I am of the opinion that they could be making a ton of money making whatever app you can think of, but eventually life will happen to them and they'll need something. And it won't be, the Porsche won't help. Though it's okay.
Hi, we have a question up here.
Okay, good.
Sorry, way up in the back. So when I was a child, you know, we used to have these feature articles in the paper, and they would always feature these amazing people that did amazing things, and they were often leaders in the community. And I, you know, in past several years, you don't see that in the paper anymore. You see a lot of bad things, and you see things about famous people. And it wasn't until Captain Sully Sullenberger, you know, saved the plane in the Hudson River that really we had these great articles about people and doing great things. And when I graduated from college, the very common thing to do was go to the Peace Corps, do Teach for America, and now people graduate and going to Wall Street and to Silicon Valley and doing all these amazing things to make a lot of money. But how much can the media do to really feature great people doing great things and really inspire our young people to follow that kind of path?
Yeah. You know, we in the media have one bias, the bias to prove we're smarter than whoever it is we're writing about. And so we tend to be hypercritical, we tend to focus on the negative, and we are now in a world where you're so intensely aware of how much your article generates page views and most emailed, and it tends to be the more critical things. But I think developing a capacity for admiration is like a fundamental part of this process. And it requires the willingness to look naive and idealistic. But finding, and I just think it's so important, I mention these people as heroes. It's so important in daily life and in historical awareness to have heroes and to find people to admire. There's a guy, 19th century educator, said often the problem with failure, and he meant moral failure, is not that they were bad, they just didn't they had an inadequate ideal. They didn't know what the ideal is. And so copying that ideal is just how we act. And so I do think we tend to be cynical and negative. Hopefully that can be gotten away from. I try to celebrate people in my column, but I must say we all have a bias toward the negative. If I could just say one thing about, you know, you mentioned TFA, Teach for America, and the Peace Corps. And of course I love those programs. I'm friends with the TFA people. But a lot of my students think, if you go into the hedge fund tech world, that's soulless sellout. And if you go to TFA or the Peace Corps, you're automatically a wonderful person. But I have found schmucks in both worlds. and wonderful people in both worlds. And I would say often it's how you lead your life, whatever you're doing, rather than what profession you go into, that automatically determines the kind of person you are.
You have a question back here?
Okay. Oh, that way in the back there.
Thank you for writing about such an important subject. What was a difficult, trying time that you had in your life that built a piece of character for you?
First of all, it's noteworthy. When you ask people, I've asked a lot of people that question, no one ever says, you know, the area in life that really made me was I had this vacation in Hawaii. It was really wonderful. Like, it's never like a good moment. You know, like, we shoot for happiness, but we're formed by suffering. There are two things. So the first thing to be said is I never went through any sort of deep crisis. And I was more plagued by just mediocrity, like just dissatisfied with myself and feeling that we all have an obligation through life just to get better and better. Now, of course, there have been moments of failure and moments of humiliation, It's something I really, and frankly, I struggle with this in the book. I want it to be honest, but I'm a big believer in privacy. I believe that private emotion is so delicate that to express it in a public forum, you simplify it and you do some damage to it. But it's, I mean, it's anybody who cares about this stuff, I did go through a divorce 3 years ago. And so that was a moment that obviously went to the formation of the book. And so those are, and the discombobulation when suddenly you're living alone in an apartment after, you know, 27 years with a family, that can't help affect but affect this kind of process. But, you know, certainly there have been other moments that were harsh. But I would say it wasn't like I fell apart. I did not have, Dante was middle age, and he, like, his life fell apart, and he wrote The Divine Comedy. Maybe if my life had fallen apart, I would have written something as good as The Divine Comedy. But no, it was more a dissatisfaction and more an inspiration of seeing people who had, as I said, the thing I did not have.
I think I'm older than anyone else here. I'm 92. And my proudest achievement sits right beside me. One of my three sons and a daughter. And I'm so proud of him because I think I've helped bring him to where he is today. Thank you for your talk. I have surely enjoyed it, and I've seen a lot.
Thank you. First, thank you for that. That was inspiring and very kind. I want to say just one thing. I didn't get a chance to read this, but it meant a lot to me. It's about how we, either for students or children, how we improve them. And I had written a column about how hard it was in a classroom to lecture people into goodness. And so I got an email from a guy named Dave Jolly, who lives in Oregon, who works up there as a veterinarian. And he wrote me an email, and he said this, and it meant a lot to me. What a wise person teaches is the smallest part of what they give. The totality of their life, of the way they go about it in the smallest details, is what gets transmitted. Never forget that the message is the person. Perfected over lifetimes of effort that was set in motion by yet another wise person, hidden from the recipient in the dim mists of time. Life is much bigger than we think, cause and effect intertwined in a vast moral structure that keeps pushing us to do better, become better, even when we dwell in the most painful and confused darkness. And so the two sentences I loved were, what a wise person teaches is the smallest part of what they give, and the message is the person. And that what we communicate and what you communicated to your sons was through your small little acts of honesty and courage and compassion that were probably communicated to you by somebody a generation before and a generation before. And I think that's a beautiful message to remember. It's what we think of our high school teachers. I can't remember what any of them taught me, but I remember the way they were. And I'm not Catholic, and I don't know much about Catholic theology, but Pope Francis, I look at him, I think the message is the person. I like the way that guy handles himself.
Much, and you have handled yourself so well tonight. We thank you so very much for being here. And thank you for Private Ocean and Book Passage. And we'll see you on May 14th for Jack Welch.